Some scholars have their doubts. When it says that Jesus was silent on the cross, as if he felt no pain, that isn't really the same thing, it is often argued, as saying that he did not feel pain. And to say that he was taken up may not mean that Christ had left Jesus. Jesus still has a miraculous body and divine power at the resurrection, for example. So the phrase about being taken up may simply be a euphemism for he died. My own view is that the gospel would not need to be actually docetic in order to be the gospel mentioned by Serapion. Serapion admitted that most of the gospel was perfectly orthodox, but he found some additions that were troubling and that could be used by docetic Christians. And certainly this gospel fits that bill. It is by and large perfectly acceptable from an orthodox perspective, but several verses might easily lend themselves to a docetic reading. This would include the major account of Jesus emerging from the tomb, where he looks as if he has anything but a real body that has just suffered the agonies of crucifixion. Whether or not this is Serapion's gospel, it is certainly a gospel of Peter. It claims its authority in the name of Jesus' closest disciple, in part, no doubt, to make its incredible and anti-Jewish narratives seem completely credible. But Peter didn't write it. This is a forgery in the name of Peter. And it's not the only one. The Epistle of Peter. Many scholars have thought of the early Christian church as seriously divided. On one side were the Jewish followers of Jesus, such as his brother James, who was the head of the church in Jerusalem, and the disciple Peter. On the other side were people like the apostle Paul, who focused on converting Gentiles, non-Jews. In this modern schema, James and Peter are often thought to have been more true to Jesus' original message, that it was the God of Israel who had brought salvation to those who kept his teachings, as found in the Jewish law. For these early Christians, Jesus was the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God to the Jewish people in fulfillment of the Jewish law. Naturally, to be a follower of this Jewish Savior, a person had to be Jewish. Gentiles were, of course, welcomed into the community with open arms, but only if they converted to Judaism. For men, that meant getting circumcised, and for both men and women, it meant observing the Sabbath, keeping kosher, and following the other Jewish laws. Paul, in this understanding, taught something quite different, that believing in the death and resurrection of Christ was the only way to have a right standing before God. Moreover, this salvation applied equally to Jews and Gentiles, so that one did not have to be a Jew to be a follower of Jesus. For Paul, according to this view, the law had passed away. Jews could keep it if they chose, and as a Jew he himself kept it, but Gentiles were not supposed to keep it. This was the national law for Israel, and it had nothing to do with salvation. Only Jesus' death and resurrection could bring salvation. Through Paul, then, the church largely filled up with Gentiles who did not see themselves as Jewish, and who worshipped the God of Israel without following his law. It is not necessary here for me to evaluate this common understanding of the relationship of Paul to the apostles before him, particularly James and Peter. But I do want to say that this idea that there was a split between their views is not just a modern notion. It goes way back to earliest Christianity. Historically speaking, it is true that Paul established churches made up of Gentiles and that he insisted that these converts not keep the Jewish law. This is a case he makes quite strenuously. For example, in the Orthonymous letter to the Galatians. For Paul, any Gentile who tried to keep the law completely misunderstood that salvation comes from Christ's death alone, to be received by faith. Keeping the law was worse than irrelevant. It was an admission that Christ's death was insufficient for salvation. See chapter 2, verses 15 through 16 and 21. Other Christians did indeed disagree. Many of them were Paul's opponents in his various churches. Later in the second Christian century, there continued to be groups of Jewish Christians who insisted that the law certainly had to be followed by anyone who wanted to belong to God's people. God had given the law, and he never changed his mind. This was the law that told people how to live. It was the law that Jesus himself taught and fulfilled, and it was the law that was to be followed, especially by followers of Christ. this split in the early church between the now minority of Jewish Christians and the dominant majority of Gentiles can be seen nowhere more clearly than in a writing forged in Peter's name called the Epistula Petri, or the Epistle of Peter. This book is not to be confused with 1 Peter or 2 Peter in the New Testament. It was written later, years after the New Testament writings had been completed. The Epistle of Peter is found as a kind of introduction to a group of writings that scholars call the Pseudo-Clementines. As implied by its scholarly name, this group of writings falsely claims, hence pseudo, to be written by Clement, who, as we saw earlier, was widely thought to have been the fourth bishop of Rome, or Pope, appointed to his position by none other than Peter. The Pseudo-Clementines have a highly complicated literary history. For over a century, scholars have strenuously debated what sources the books used, how the various writings are related to each other, and other technical questions. But the basic character of the writings is clear. These are accounts of the travels and adventures of Clement, especially as he converts to Christianity through Peter's preaching, and then journeys with Peter as the apostle spreads the gospel, gives speeches, and performs miracles. These include miracle contests with the arch-heretic Simon the Magician, whom we saw earlier. The Acts of Peter may have been one of the sources for these stories. The Clementine books clearly were not written by the historical Clement, but long after his death, even though they are allegedly narrated by him in the first person. They are, therefore, forged. In one set of these writings, the adventures of Clement are prefaced by the Epistle of Peter, a letter supposedly written by Peter to the brother of Jesus, James, head of the church in Jerusalem. The letter instructs James not to allow Peter's writings to be handed over to just anyone, because they might be misinterpreted or altered, but only to a select group of trustworthy people. The author, Peter, attacks Christians who interpret his message as saying that the Jewish law is no longer in force. "That is completely false," says the author, "for Jesus himself had indicated that not one jot or tittle will pass away from the law, and that it would be eternally valid." See Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 20. According to this letter, one of Peter's opponents in particular has led the Gentiles to reject Peter's lawful preaching, and instead to prefer a lawless and absurd doctrine of the man who is my enemy. It does not take a lot of thought to realize who the enemy is whom Peter is opposing. It is someone who preaches to the Gentiles, insists on a gospel apart from the Jewish law, a lawless doctrine, and claims that Peter himself subscribes to that view. See Galatians 2. Without naming him, this author is talking about Paul. Here we have a view of Peter and Paul very much at odds with what we find in some of the writings of the New Testament. In the history of the early church found in the book of Acts, for example, Peter and Paul see eye to eye. They agree on every major point. They stand arm in arm in the mission to spread the gospel, and most important, they wholeheartedly concur that Gentiles do not need to be Jews to be followers of Jesus. See Acts chapters 10 through 11 and 15. This is not the case, however, for the author of the Epistle of Peter. Here, there is a clear split between Peter, Jesus' closest disciple, and Paul, an interloper who has misinterpreted Peter. Paul has misrepresented the gospel. This, then, is an author who saw Paul as the enemy, and his lawless and absurd doctrine as heresy. For this author, Paul not only disagreed with Peter, he was wrong. And on what authority does the author claim this? On the authority of Peter himself. The author forged the letter in Peter's name in order to make his point. The Apocalypse of Peter. I will not be talking at length in this book about how we got our 27 books of the New Testament, that is, how the canon was formed and how some writings came to be included and others left out. Plenty of other books describe this process at length. I can say, though, that there were some writings that were a close call, that nearly made it in but did not, just as there were others that nearly were left out but finally made it in. One of the books that nearly made it in is called The Apocalypse of Peter. From authors such as Eusebius, we know that there were Christian communities as late as the 4th century who thought that the Apocalypse of Peter should be included in the canon, either in place of the Apocalypse of John, that is, the Book of Revelation, which obviously ended up being included, or alongside it. The Apocalypse of Peter is very different from the Apocalypse of John, however. Both books are apocalypses, in which an author is given a secret revelation about the divine, heavenly mysteries that can make sense of the mundane, earthly realities. In the New Testament Apocalypse of John, these mysteries have to do with the future course of history to be unfurled on earth, as has been decided already in heaven. In the non-canonical Apocalypse of Peter, these mysteries have to do with the fate of souls in life after death. This book describes a personal tour that Peter is given of the realms of the blessed and of the damned. Most readers are familiar with the idea of a tour of heaven and hell from Dante's Divine Comedy. Dante did not invent the idea, however. He stood in a long line of Christian authors who used the motif of a tour of the afterlife in order to make whatever important points they wanted to stress about life here on earth. Our earliest example of this kind of writing is the Apocalypse of Peter. Here again, we knew about the book for centuries before it was available. As it turns out, it was another of the four texts found in the 66-page book uncovered by archaeologists near Akhmim, Egypt, in 1886-87. Since then, an Ethiopic version has been found, which gives an even fuller account. The narrative begins with Peter and the disciples talking with Jesus on the Mount of Olives. See Mark chapter 13. They ask Jesus about what will happen when the world comes to an end, and he provides them with a brief account. But then, the discussion shifts to a description, given in some graphic detail, of what happens to souls after they die, either in the place of torment or the place of eternal bliss. As sometimes happens in these personal tours of heaven and hell, the description of the realms of the blessed is a bit stereotypical and brief. There are, after all, only so many ways you can describe eternal, ecstatic joy. It's fantastic. What more can one say? The realms of the damned, however, are a different matter altogether. Anyone with any creativity and imagination can invent lurid and detailed descriptions of the torments of sinners. In Peter's vision, a number of the damned are tortured in ways that befit their characteristic sins, so that the punishment fits the crime. Those who have blasphemed against the ways of God, for example, that is, sinned by what they've said, are hanged by their tongues over eternal flames. Women who have braided their hair in order to make themselves attractive to men so as to seduce them are hanged by their hair over eternal flames. The men they seduced are hanged by a different body part over the flames. In this case, the men cry out, as you might imagine, "We didn't know it would come to this!" The overarching message of this book is quite clear and not altogether subtle. If you want to enjoy the amazing blessings of paradise and avoid the horrific torments of hell, don't sin. This message conveys a reliable and incontrovertible truth. Those who fail to follow God's will face eternal torture. How do we know? Because someone who has observed the realms of the damned has told us. Jesus' right-hand man, Peter himself. In order to get his point across, the author writes in the first person, not in his own name, but in the name of the chief disciple. Here again, we have a forgery in the name of Peter. Petrine Writings in the New Testament. The books I have talked about here at some length, the Acts of Peter, the Gospel of Peter, the Pseudo-Clementine Writings, the Epistle of Peter, the Apocalypse of Peter, are not the only fabrications about Peter and forgeries allegedly written by Peter from the early church. There were others. Other Acts of Peter, a collection called the Preaching of Peter, two other Apocalypses of Peter, and these are just the ones we still have today. No one knows how many once existed. Producing books in the name of Peter was a virtual cottage industry in the early church. Is it possible, in light of this extensive use of Peter's name to authorize others' views, that any forgeries in the name of Peter made it into the New Testament? As it turns out, two books bear Peter's name there as well. The letters of 1 Peter and 2 Peter both claim to be written by Peter, but there are solid reasons for thinking that Peter did not write either one. 1 Peter. The book of 1 Peter is allegedly written by Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to Christians whom he calls exiles in five provinces in the western part of what is now Turkey. There is no doubt that the author is claiming to be Jesus' closest disciple, Peter. Peter was not a personal name before Peter was given it as a nickname by Jesus himself. According to the Gospels, this disciple's real name was Simon. But Jesus indicated that he would be the rock, Greek Petros, on whom the church would be founded. So he called him Rocky, or Peter. See Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 18. So, as far as we know, there were no other persons named Peter until later times when Christians started naming their children after the great apostle. So the author of 1 Peter is certainly claiming to be that Peter. This is borne out by his comment in chapter 5, verse 1, that he was personally a witness of the sufferings of Christ. This matter of suffering is the key theme of the book. In fact, the word suffering occurs more often in this short five-chapter letter than in any other book of the entire New Testament, including the Gospels, which are much, much longer. The author assumes that his readers themselves are undergoing persecution and that they will be experiencing yet more in the future. Now, for a little while, he tells them, they have had to suffer various trials. But that is all to the good, because through being tested, their faith will be refined and become more precious than gold that is tested by fire. Chapter 1, verses 6 through 7. They should not, therefore, be surprised at the fiery ordeal that is coming, as if something strange were happening. But they are to rejoice, because they share in the sufferings of Christ. Chapter 4, verses 12 through 13. Scholars have long debated what kind of suffering the author has in mind. The older view was that the author was dealing with official state persecutions, such as happened when the Emperor Nero imprisoned and then executed Christians in the city of Rome in 64 CE, blaming them for starting the horrible fire that destroyed much of the city, a fire that his own arsonists may have set. But over the past 20 years or so, scholars have begun to stress that the book of 1 Peter never says much about official persecution, where Christians are arrested, put on trial for their faith, and martyred. Instead, the opposition seems to come from former friends and neighbors who do not understand or appreciate the Christian's new lifestyle, which is removed from the joyful celebrations of pagan religions. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 5. That is to say, Christians stopped attending pagan festivals to form their own secret societies, and pagans became upset, suspicious, and hateful, leading to local opposition to Christians that could at times turn nasty. If this is the case, it makes sense that the author stresses to his readers that it is important for them to be obedient to the government and governing officials, chapter 2, verses 13 through 15, to show good conduct among outsiders, chapter 2, verse 12, to be devoted slaves, wives, and husbands, chapter 2, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 7, to do nothing to warrant any opposition, but to suffer only for doing what is right, chapter 2, verse 20. A good deal of the exhortation and encouragement to his readers is based on a sophisticated interpretation of key passages in the Old Testament, quoted, of course, in Greek, the so-called Septuagint, the legendary origins of which are described in the forged Letter of Aristeas, described in chapter 1, as can be seen, for example, in chapter 1, verses 24 through 25, chapter 2, verse 3, also verses 6 through 9, 22, 24 through 25, and chapter 3, verses 10 through 12. The author ends his exhortation to be steadfast in the face of adversity by indicating that he has written his letter through Silvanus, a faithful brother, that is, a true Christian, and by sending greetings from she who is in Babylon, who is also chosen. Chapter 5, verse 13. Scholars have long realized what this last bit means. Babylon was the city that was seen as the ultimate enemy of God among Jews, since it was Babylon that had defeated Judah and destroyed Jerusalem and its temple in the 6th century BCE. By the end of the 1st century, Christians and Jews had started using the word Babylon as a code word for the city that was the enemy of God in their own day, the city of Rome, which also destroyed Jerusalem and its temple in the year 70. See, for example, Revelations chapter 14, verse 8, and chapter 17, verse 5. The author then is claiming to be writing from the city of Rome. This makes sense given the later traditions that associated Peter with the city of Rome, in fact, as its first bishop, the first pope. But tradition also indicates that Peter was martyred in Rome under Nero in 64 CE. Would it make sense that he would be calling Rome Babylon before the Romans had destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70? By the time that catastrophe hit, Peter was long dead. As it turns out, there are other very good grounds for thinking that Peter did not actually write this book. It was written by someone claiming to be Peter. Before explaining some of those grounds, we should first look at the second letter in the New Testament written in Peter's name. 2 Peter. There is less debate among scholars of the New Testament about the authorship of 2 Peter than for any of the other books sometimes considered forgeries. Whoever wrote 2 Peter, it was not Simon Peter. The author certainly claims to be Peter, even more explicitly than in the case of 1 Peter. He introduces himself as Simeon Peter, a slave and apostle of Jesus Christ. But more than that, he claims personally to have been present at the transfiguration scene narrated in the Gospels, where Jesus was transformed before the eyes of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, and began speaking with Moses and Elijah, before a voice came from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." See Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 through 8. The author insists that he himself was there to hear these words, brought to him by the voice of the majestic glory, chapter 1, verse 17. The author wants there to be no doubt he is Peter. His chief concern is that there are false teachers in the community who have twisted the true message of the gospel. Most of chapter 2 is devoted to maligning these persons, without ever explaining what exactly they teach. This highly vituperative attack calls their teachings destructive heresies, and says that they, the opponents, are licentious, greedy, and exploitative. The author indicates that they will suffer like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, and like the inhabitants of the entire world in the days of Noah. That is to say, they too will be destroyed. He calls them ignorant, and says they are blots and blemishes, reveling in their dissipation, carousing. He says they have eyes that are full of adultery, unslakable for sin, and on and on. This assault on his opponents, the false prophets, contains numerous verbal similarities to what can be found in the New Testament book of Jude. The parallels are so numerous that scholars are virtually unified in thinking that the author has taken Jude's message and simply edited a bit to incorporate it into his book. In addition to the false teachers, scoffers have appeared who mock the Christian view that Jesus is soon to return from heaven in judgment on the earth. If he was supposed to come soon, say these skeptics, why hasn't he come? A lot of time has passed, and everything goes on just the same as before. The author replies that these unbelievers are ignorant and deceived, having forgotten that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are as one day. Chapter 3, verse 8. In other words, even if Jesus waits another 3,000 years, he still is coming soon. Jesus has in fact delayed returning simply to give people a chance to repent before the coming destruction. Paul himself, the author tells us, taught such things in all his letters, which the ignorant and unstable people twist, as they do with all the other scriptures, to their own destruction. Chapter 3, verse 16. One of the reasons virtually all scholars agree that Peter did not actually write this letter is that the situation being presupposed appears to be of much later times. When Peter himself died, say, the year 64 under Nero, there was still eager expectation that Jesus would return soon. Not even a full generation had passed since the crucifixion. It was only with the passing of time that the Christian claim that all would take place within this generation, Mark chapter 13, verse 30, and before the disciples had tasted death, chapter 9, verse 1, started to ring hollow. By the time 2 Peter was written, Christians were having to defend themselves in the face of opponents who mocked their view that the end was supposed to be imminent. So, Peter, has to explain that even if the end is thousands of years off, it is still right around the corner by God's calendar. Everything is still on schedule. Moreover, the author of 2 Peter is writing at a time when there was already a collection of Paul's letters in circulation, and these letters were being considered on a par with the Old Testament scriptures, chapter 3, verse 16. This could not have been during Paul's lifetime, and early church tradition indicates that both Peter and Paul were killed during the reign of Nero. These are among the reasons for thinking that 2 Peter almost certainly could not have been written by Peter. And there is one more compelling reason. There are excellent grounds for thinking that Peter could not write. Simon Peter, Ancient Palestine, and Literacy. What do we know about literacy and the ability to write in the ancient world, especially in rural Palestine, where Simon Peter was born and raised? Scholars of antiquity have been diligent over the past 25 years or so in trying to understand every aspect of ancient literacy and education. In what is now the classic study, the 1989 book Ancient Literacy, William Harris, professor of ancient history at Columbia University, shows that modern assumptions about literacy simply are not applicable to ancient times. Today, in modern America, we live in a world where nearly every child goes to school and learns to read and write. Just about everyone we know can read the sports page and copy out a page of a novel if they choose. But the phenomenon of massive and widespread literacy is completely modern. Before the Industrial Revolution, societies had no compelling reasons to invest enormous amounts of money and other resources into creating a literate population. It was only with the development of the industrial world that such a thing became both desirable and feasible. Harris argues that in the ancient world, at the very best of times, only about 10% of the population was reasonably literate. By the best of times, he means Athens, a center of learning, at the height of its intellectual power, during the days of Socrates and Plato, 5th to 4th century BCE. Most of these 10% were men, as might be expected in a highly patriarchal society, and all of them were in the upper classes, the social and economic elite who had the leisure and the money, well, their parents had the money, to afford an education. Lower class people did not learn how to read, let alone write. And the vast majority of people in the ancient world were in the lower classes. To the surprise of many, the middle class is another invention of the Industrial Revolution. In the ancient world, virtually everyone was high or low or very, very low. The only notable exceptions were slaves, who were naturally a very low class indeed, but who were sometimes educated at their master's expense so that they could carry out household duties that required literacy skills, such as taking care of the household finances, helping with correspondence, or teaching the children. When I say that few people could read, let alone write, I mean to signal something else quite significant about the ancient world. When upper-class people were educated, reading and writing were taught as two different skills. Today we learn reading and writing together, and we naturally assume that if people can read, they can also write. Not necessarily write a novel, but at least a letter. But that's because of the way we have set up our educational system. There is nothing inherent in learning to read that can necessarily teach you how to write. I know this full well personally. I can read Greek, Hebrew, French, German, and a range of other languages, but I cannot compose a letter in any of these languages. I learned how to read all of them in graduate school so I could read ancient documents in their original languages and modern scholarship in the languages of Europe. But I never learned how to write them. Most people in the ancient world could not read, and those who could read often could not write. And in this case, by write, I mean that most people, even if they could copy down words, could not compose a sentence, let alone a well-argued treatise. On the contrary, the people who could compose an ethical essay, a learned philosophical discussion, or an involved religious treatise were highly educated and highly exceptional. And that was in the very best of times. Very, very few people indeed were able to perform these skills in a language other than the one they were raised with. I'm not saying that just 1% of the population could do such a thing. I'm saying that far fewer than 1% of the population could do it. It is sometimes thought that Palestine was an exception, that in Palestine, Jewish boys all learned to read so that they could study the Hebrew scriptures, and that since they could read, they could probably write. Moreover, it is often argued that in Palestine, most adults were bilingual or even trilingual, able to read Hebrew, speak the local language, Aramaic, and communicate well in the language of the broader empire, Greek. Recent studies of literacy in Palestine, however, have shown convincingly that none of these assertions is true. The fullest, most thoroughly researched, and most widely influential study of literacy in Palestine during the period of the Roman Empire is by Catherine Hezer. After examining all of the evidence, Hezer concludes that in Roman Palestine, the best guesstimate is that something like 3% of the population could read, and that the majority of these would have been in the cities and larger towns. Most people outside of the urban areas would scarcely ever see a written text. Some smaller towns and villages may have had a literacy level of around 1%. Moreover, these literate people were almost always the elite of the upper classes. Those who learned to read learned how to read Hebrew, not Greek. And what is more, once again, far more people could read than could write. The people who knew how to write were primarily men who were priests. In fact, for the entire 1st century CE, the time of Jesus and Simon Peter, we know for certain of only two authors in Palestine who produced literary works, that is, educated compositions other than tax documents, land deeds or marriage certificates, etc. The Jewish historian Josephus and a man named Justus of Tiberias. We still have Josephus's writings, but Justus's don't survive. Both of these men were in the upper echelons of society, and both were inordinately well-educated. We know of no other literary authors for the entire century. Was Peter in Josephus's and Justus's class? No, not even close. What about Greek education in the land of Peter's birth and upbringing? It is sometimes assumed that since Galilee, the northern part of what we think of as Israel, was occasionally called Galilee of the Gentiles. It was overrun by Gentiles in Jesus and Peter's day. And according to a common kind of logic, if there were lots of Gentiles in Galilee, they would have spoken Greek. So, to get along, everyone must have spoken Greek. As it turns out, that's not true either. The most recent thorough studies of Gentiles in Galilee have been undertaken by the American scholar Mark Chancy. Chancy has studied every archaeological find from Galilee from around the time of the 1st century, has read every single piece of writing from the period of any relevance, and draws a decisive conclusion. The Gentiles in Galilee were almost exclusively located in the two major cities, Sepphoris and Tiberias. All the rest of Galilee was predominantly Jewish. And since most of Galilee was rural, not urban, the vast majority of Jews had no encounters with Gentiles. Moreover, Greek was not widely, let alone normally, spoken. The vast majority of Jews spoke Aramaic and had no facility in Greek. How do all these findings affect our question of whether Peter wrote 1st and 2nd Peter or any other books? Was Peter among the very upper echelons of the educated elite of Palestine who could compose letter essays in Greek? Apart from the legendary accounts I have mentioned, all we know about Peter's life comes to us from the New Testament. What we principally learn about him is that before he was a follower of Jesus, he was a fisherman from Capernaum in Galilee. In order to evaluate Peter's linguistic abilities, the place to begin, then, is with Capernaum. A full summary of what we know about Capernaum from Peter's day is provided by an American archaeologist of Palestine, Jonathan Reed. On the basis of archaeological digs and historical sources, it is clear that Capernaum was a historically insignificant village in rural Galilee. It is never mentioned in any ancient source prior to the Gospels. It is scarcely mentioned by any sources after that. It was discovered by archaeologists in the 19th century and has been excavated since then. In the time of Jesus, it may have had anywhere between 6 and 1,500 inhabitants. So, say 1,000. The archaeological digs have revealed no evidence of any public buildings whatsoever, such as shops or storage facilities. The market for buying food and other necessities must have been held in tents or booths in open, unpaved public areas. The town is on none of the major international trade routes. The Roman roads in the area date from 100 years after Peter's life. There is no trace of any pagan or Gentile population in the town. There are no inscriptions of any kind on any of the buildings. Reed concludes that the inhabitants were almost certainly predominantly illiterate. Archaeologists have found no building structures or materials associated with social elites from the first century. For example, plaster surfaces, decorative frescoes, marble mosaics, red ceramic roof tiles. The houses were roughly constructed out of stone basalt, and mud or clay was used to fill in the gaps. They probably had thatched roofs. In short, Peter's town was a backwoods Jewish village made up of hand-to-mouth laborers who did not have an education. Everyone spoke Aramaic. Nothing suggests that anyone could speak Greek. Nothing suggests that anyone in town could write. As a lower-class fisherman, Peter would have started work as a young boy and never attended school. There was, in fact, probably no school there. If there was a school, he probably didn't attend. If he did attend, it would have been in order to receive rudimentary training in how to read Hebrew. But that almost certainly never happened. Peter was an illiterate peasant. This should come as no surprise, really. As it turns out, there is New Testament evidence about Peter's education level. According to Acts, chapter 4, verse 13, both Peter and his companion John, also a fisherman, were agrammatoi, a Greek word that literally means unlettered, that is, illiterate. And so, is it possible that Peter wrote 1st and 2nd Peter? We have seen good reasons for believing he did not write 2nd Peter, and some reason for thinking he didn't write 1st Peter. But it is highly probable that, in fact, he could not write at all. I should point out that the book of 1 Peter is written by a highly literate, highly educated, Greek-speaking Christian who is intimately familiar with the Jewish scriptures in their Greek translation, the Septuagint. This is not Peter. It is theoretically possible, of course, that Peter decided to go to school after Jesus' resurrection. In this imaginative, not to say imaginary, scenario, he learned his alphabet, learned how to sound out syllables and then words, learned to read, and learned to write. Then he took Greek classes, mastered Greek as a foreign language, and started memorizing large chunks of the Septuagint, after which he took Greek composition classes and learned how to compose complicated and rhetorically effective sentences. Then, toward the end of his life, he wrote 1 Peter. Is this scenario plausible? Apart from the fact that we don't know of adult education classes in antiquity, there's no evidence they existed. I think most reasonable people would conclude that Peter probably had other things on his mind and on his hands after he came to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. He probably never thought for a single second about learning how to become a rhetorically skilled Greek author. Some scholars have suggested that Peter did not directly write 1 Peter. As I've indicated, almost no one thinks he wrote 2 Peter, but that he indirectly wrote it, for example, by dictating the letter to a scribe. Some have noted that the letter is written through Silvanus, chapter 5, verse 12, and thought that maybe Silvanus wrote down Peter's thoughts for him. I deal with this question of whether scribes or secretaries actually ever composed such letter essays in chapter 4. The answer is almost certainly not. But for now, I can say at least a couple of words about the case of 1 Peter. First off, scholars now widely recognize that when the author indicates that he wrote the book through Silvanus, he is indicating not the name of his secretary, but the person who was carrying the letter to the recipients. Authors who used secretaries don't refer to them in this way. But why not suppose that Peter used someone else other than Silvanus as a secretary? It would help to imagine how this theory is supposed to work exactly. Peter could not have dictated this letter in Greek to a secretary any more than he could have written it in Greek. That would have required him to be perfectly fluent in Greek, to have mastered rhetorical techniques in Greek, and to have had an immediate familiarity with the Jewish scriptures in Greek. None of that is plausible. Nor can one easily think that he dictated the letter in Aramaic and the secretary translated it into Greek. The letter does not read like a Greek translation of an Aramaic original, but as an original Greek composition with Greek rhetorical flourishes. Moreover, The letter presupposes the knowledge of the Greek Old Testament. So the person who composed the letter, whether orally or in writing, must have known the scriptures in Greek. Is it possible, then, that the historical Peter directed someone to write a letter, basically told him what to say, and let him produce it? To that, there are two responses. First, it would seem that if someone else actually composed the letter, it would be that person, not Peter, who was the author. But the other person is never named. Even in Paul's letters that are co-authored, almost all of them, he names the others, even though he probably wrote them himself. In this case, Peter would not have even written the thing, and it should be remembered that there are good grounds for thinking that the letter was written after Peter had died, since it alludes to Rome's destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. But even more compelling is this. Where in the ancient world do we have anything at all analogous to this hypothetical situation of someone writing a letter essay for someone else and putting the other person's name on it, the name of the person who did not write it, rather than his own name? So far as I know, there is not a single instance of any such procedure attested from antiquity or any discussion in any ancient source of this being a legitimate practice, or even an illegitimate one. Such a thing is never discussed. There are plenty of instances of another phenomenon, however. This is the phenomenon of Christian authors writing pseudonymous works, falsely claiming to be a famous person. Ancient scholars would have called a book like that a falsely inscribed writing. A lie, an illegitimate child. Modern people would simply call it a forgery. Chapter 3. Forgeries in the Name of Paul. When I became a born-again Christian in 1971, I was eager to read and learn all I could about the scriptures. I had no idea at the time that there was such a thing as biblical scholarship, or that there were books written by real experts who had mastered the relevant ancient languages, Greek and Hebrew, for example, and plumbed all the ancient sources for years on end in order to provide historically accurate accounts. I was just as happy with a good novel about, say, Jesus or Paul, as with something serious. And novels, of course, make for easy reading. Just the sort of thing I liked. During the preceding year, one of the best-selling biblical novels of all time had appeared, Taylor Caldwell's Great Lion of God, a fictional account of the life of the Apostle Paul. For 8 months, it had been on the New York Times bestseller list, and as far as I was concerned, if that many people read it, it must be accurate and informative. So I devoured it. It was only later in life that I realized just how much fiction there was in this historical novel. I remember, years after, fervently hoping that I hadn't gotten too much of my common knowledge about Paul from this fantastical account. The one episode that stuck with me over the years involved Caldwell's attempt to explain why Paul was so ripe for conversion to become a follower of Jesus after being such a violent persecutor of the church. The way she mapped out the scenario, roughly, was this. As a very young teenager, Paul was extremely zealous for his Jewish faith and strove mightily to keep the Jewish law. But at one point, he succumbed to an irresistible temptation. It involved a tryst out at the local lake with a dark-haired slave girl. This sexual encounter created an enormous burden of guilt in the young Paul, which he tried to assuage by becoming even more hyper-religious. As a young man, he heard of the followers of Jesus, who were preaching that salvation can come to people who do not keep the law. Salvation comes simply through faith in Christ. Paul became incensed and got official permission to oppose and persecute them. This was a further way of working out his own personal guilt. By engaging in religious zeal, he assuaged his conscience. But he found that the harder and harder he pressed for keeping the Jewish law in all its rigorous details, the more overwhelmed he was with guilt for having broken it. Then he had a vision of Jesus on the road to Damascus. He realized for the first time both that he could not really keep the law and that he did not need to. Jesus brought a release from the deeply hidden guilt within him, and out of profound gratitude, he threw himself with equal zeal into being a missionary for the church, rather than its persecutor. Caldwell's long book was a compelling read, especially for an eager teenager wanting to know more about the truth of his newfound faith. As it turns out, though, the entire plot is a fiction. There is no historical record of Paul's sexual fling at the local pond, and no indication that he felt tremendous guilt over being unable to keep the law, even though a lot of Christians continue to misinterpret Paul that way. We have a reasonable understanding of what Paul thought, since he has left us some letters, all in the New Testament. When he talks about his Jewish life before Jesus, even though he does indicate that he was extremely zealous for the law, he makes it quite clear that it was not because of guilt over being unable to keep it. On the contrary, Paul indicates that, as a faithful Jew, he was blameless in keeping the law. Philippians chapter 3, verse 6. When he became a follower of Jesus, it was not to resolve internal conflict and guilt. It was because he came to realize that Christ's death was the only thing important for salvation, and everything else, even the law, was as worthless as garbage, as he puts it in Philippians chapter 3, verse 8. Taylor Caldwell, of course, had access to Paul's own writings and could have known what he actually said about his life before Jesus. But probably the reality of his life didn't make as good a story as the idea of the tryst with the slave girl. Having the true account from the horse's mouth, or in this case, the great lion's, has never stopped people from telling fictional accounts about Paul. Ancient fictions about Paul. Of all the Christians who have ever lived, probably no one has had more stories told about him than Paul. We still have a number of ancient legendary accounts, just as we have for Peter. In the case of Paul, we have a record of someone actually being caught red-handed fabricating stories about him and being punished for it. Ancient people saw fabrications about historical figures, that is, made-up stories, much as they saw forgeries, false authorial claims. They were pseuda, falsehoods or lies, and they normally were not tolerated. Many of the ancient fabricated accounts can be found in a book that has survived the ravages of time only in bits and pieces, called The Acts of Paul. The narrative describes the missionary activities of Paul, his preaching, and his amazing miracles. Probably the most famous part of the story involves Paul's conversion of a wealthy young woman named Thecla, who abandons her fiancé to become Paul's devoted follower. Paul is said to have arrived in the city of Iconium and to have been welcomed into the house of a Christian named Onesiphorus. There he preaches a sermon. But it is a sermon quite unlike anything Paul himself teaches in his own letters in the New Testament, where his message always concerns the need to believe in Jesus' death and resurrection for salvation. Here, in the Acts of Paul, the apostle's message is one of sexual abstinence. Only the pure in heart and body, preserved through remaining sexually chaste, can inherit the kingdom. This applies not only to single people, but also to those who are married. Sex is forbidden. Thecla, who lives next door, happens to be sitting in her second floor window and overhears the sermon. She is engaged to a wealthy and prominent man, but decides on the basis of what she has heard to abandon her wedding plans and follow Paul. Her mother and her aggrieved fiancé try to dissuade her, but to no avail. Rejected and angry, they turn her over to the authorities to be burned at the stake for violating social custom. She miraculously escapes and becomes Paul's follower. The rest of the story is about her adventures with Paul and her persecutions. In another city, she resists the sexual advances of an aristocrat and once more is condemned to death. This time, she is to be thrown to the wild beasts. She is upset, though, that she might die before she has been baptized into her new faith. Seeing a vat of water filled with man-eating seals, whatever those might be, she throws herself in and declares herself baptized. God performs another miracle, and Thecla escapes intact. Finally, she reunites with the Apostle Paul, informs him of her desire to spread the word of the gospel, and is authorized by him to do so. I've given just a brief sketch here of this fairly long and interesting story. The full account was very popular among some Christian groups in the early centuries, and it caused quite a stir among church leaders who were offended by the significant role it gave to Thecla as someone who could baptize herself and preach the gospel, even though she was a woman. By the second century, most churches reserved such ministerial duties for men. But these stories, through no less significant a figure than Paul, seemed to authorize women to engage in them. Moreover, the Gospel of Paul in this text is all about sexual abstinence and the avoidance of marriage. In other churches, it was taught that the family was important, that the male leaders of the churches should be married, that their wives should have babies and be submissive to their husbands in all things. The alternative perspective of the Thecla story led to some serious divisions in the church. We know this because the first time an ancient author mentions the story, it is in order to oppose it. The writer was the famous Christian theologian, defender of the faith, and misogynist, Tertullian, who, around 200 CE, wrote a treatise on baptism. In this treatise, he attacks women who used the story of Thecla as a justification for practicing baptism, since, for Tertullian, only men should be allowed to baptize. Tertullian argues that this story of Thecla was fabricated and had no historical value. In fact, he says the author of the story was an elder, presbyter, in a church of Asia Minor. He was caught fabricating the account, was put on trial in the church, and was relieved of his duties. Thus, for Tertullian, the story cannot be used to authorize women's baptism practices. Scholars frequently cite this brief but fascinating passage from Tertullian in order to show that forgers were not welcomed in the church. I wish that were the point of the story, since I think it is true that forgers were not welcome. But, unfortunately, the story is not about a forger. It is about a fabricator. This Asia Minor presbyter did not write a book claiming to be Paul. He wrote a book with fabricated stories about Paul. At the same time, it is true to say that he was treated as forgers were also generally treated. He was severely reprimanded for not speaking the truth. With good reason, a number of scholars have argued that the presbyter did not actually invent these stories about Thecla, but simply retold them, editing them for his own purpose. In other words, the stories were floating around in the oral tradition for a long time before the end of the second century when he produced his account. This may well be the case, as we will see later in this chapter when we return to the stories. But in any event, somebody made up the stories, since they are not historical. The author or editor who wrote them down was found out, and the consequences were not good. Non-canonical writings forged in the name of Paul. If Christians made up stories about Paul, did they also make up writings allegedly by Paul? This is the question we asked about Peter in chapter 2, and the answer here will be the same. There are numerous forgeries in the name of Paul from the early church, all of them, so far as we can tell, written to authorize certain views in the name of this great author. Some of these forgeries survive. We know of other forgeries that once existed but have since been lost. Forgeries perpetrated by Martian. You might think that someone of Paul's stature would have been a unifying influence on the early church. As it turns out, nothing could be farther from the truth. At about the time the presbyter of Asia Minor was producing stories about Paul that led to splits over the role of women in the church, an even bigger menace to the church's unity was coming from a completely different direction. It involved the teachings of one of Paul's greatest early admirers, the second-century teacher and theologian, Martian. It is unfortunate that we no longer have any of Martian's own writings. They were deemed heretical, false teachings, and destroyed. What we do have are the writings of his opponents, including especially the already mentioned Tertullian, who wrote a 5-volume refutation of Martian's teachings. We still have this work, and it is a gold mine of information about one of the most divisive persons in the history of the early church. Martian came from the city of Sinope, on the southern coast of the Black Sea. His father was reportedly a bishop of the local church, and so Martian was raised, in the early 2nd century, in a Christian household. His family was from the upper class, and he himself became an entrepreneur as a young man, apparently in the shipbuilding business. After he amassed a good deal of wealth, he left Asia Minor for the capital city of the empire, Rome, where he joined the church and participated actively in its ministry. Scholars have traditionally dated Martian's time in Rome as 139 to 144 CE. It was in Rome that Martian developed his distinctive theological ideas. Martian was especially attracted to Paul's idea that a person is made right with God not by doing the requirements of the Jewish law, the works of the law, as Paul puts it, but only by having faith in Christ's death and resurrection. Paul, in such books as Galatians and Romans in the New Testament, emphasizes that no one can be right with God through the works of the law. He preached his gospel, literally the good news, to Gentiles, telling them that Christ's death could bring a reconciliation with God for all who have faith. Martian saw this contrast between the law of the Jews and the gospel of Christ in extreme terms, and pushed the contrast to what he saw as its logical consequences. Where there is law, there is no gospel. The law and the gospel are fundamentally distinct. They are contrary things. The Old Testament has nothing to do with the gospel of Paul. The necessary conclusion for Martian was that the God who gave the Jewish law must not be the God who saved people from their sins, which they incurred by breaking the law. In other words, the Old Testament God was not the same as the God of Jesus and his apostle Paul. There were literally two gods. Martian argued that the God of the Old Testament was the Jewish God who created this world, chose Israel to be his people, and then gave them his law. No one was able to keep this law, however, so the Old Testament God was perfectly justified in condemning everyone to damnation. He was a just, wrathful God. Not evil, just ruthlessly judicial. The God of Jesus, on the other hand, was a God of love, mercy, and forgiveness. This good God, superior to the God of the Jews, sent Jesus into the world in order to die for the sins of others, to save people from the wrathful God of the Old Testament. Salvation comes, then, by believing in Jesus' death. Martian set out to prove his doctrine of the two gods by writing a book called Antitheses, that is, the contrary statements. In it, he showed that there were severe inconsistencies between the Old Testament and the teachings of Jesus and Paul. The God of the Old Testament, for example, orders the Israelites to take over the Promised Land, first by destroying the city of Jericho, Joshua chapter 6. He instructs them to go into the city and slaughter every man, woman, and child in it. "Is this the same God," asks Martian, "who says, 'Love your enemies, turn the other cheek, and pray for those who persecute you'? It doesn't sound like the same God, because it's not. The God of the Old Testament sent his prophets, one of whom was Elijah. One day, we are told in the Old Testament, Elijah was verbally harassed by a group of boys making fun of his bald head. Elijah called the wrath of God down upon the boys, and two she-bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of them to death. 2 Kings chapter 2. Is this the same God who said, 'Let the little children come unto me'? No, there are two different gods. Since the God of Jesus is not the God of the Old Testament, and is therefore not the creator of the world, Jesus could not belong to this created order. He could not be born into this world as a flesh and blood being, otherwise he would belong to the God of the Jews, just as every other created being does. Jesus must have come from heaven, from the true God, directly. For that reason, he was not an actual physical human being. He only seemed to be." In other words, Martian was a Docetist. See chapter 2. For this view, he could again appeal to the writings of Paul, who stated that Jesus came into this world in the likeness of sinful flesh. Romans chapter 8, verse 3. For Martian, it was all an appearance. Martian is the first Christian of record to have insisted on a distinct canon of Scripture, that is, a collection of books he considered sacred authorities. Martian's canon was remarkably short by most standards. Since the Jewish God was not the true God, his book was not part of the Christian Scriptures. There was no Christian Old Testament. The canon, instead, was made up of two sections. One part consisted of Paul's letters. Martian apparently knew 10 of these, all the ones in the New Testament, except 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, the so-called pastoral letters. Moreover, in his letters, Paul constantly refers to his gospel. So Martian included, as the other part of his canon, a gospel account of the life of Jesus. This was apparently a version of the Gospel of Luke. The problem with this 11-book canon is that even these books quote the Old Testament as an authority and seem to affirm the creation as coming from the true God. How could that be, if Martian's view of Paul and Jesus were right? Martian had an easy answer to that. He believed that after Jesus left this earth, his followers, the disciples, changed his teachings and went back to their old Jewish ways, misinterpreting his gospel message and turning it around to affirm the goodness of the Creator God and his creation. They never fully understood Jesus' teaching that the Creator was not the true God. That is why Paul had to be called to be an apostle. The apostles before him had altered Jesus' teachings, and so Paul was commissioned to set things straight. According to Martian, this wide misinterpretation of Jesus' message had affected lots of other Christians, including the scribes who copied the writings of Paul and Luke. These 11 books had in fact been miscopied over the years. Scribes who did not understand the truth that there are two gods, that Jesus was not really born and is not really human and so on, altered the texts and inserted false views into them. Martian then edited his 11 books, eliminating from them portions that seemed too Jewish. In addition to these 11 books, Martian and his followers had other books forged in Paul's name. We know this from a fragmentary text that comes to us from the 2nd century, a text that discusses which books belong in the true canon of Scripture, as opposed to the canons of Martian and other heretics. This text is called the Muratorian Canon, named after the Italian scholar Muratori, who discovered it. Among other things, the Muratorian Canon indicates that the Martianites, the followers of Martian, had forged two books in the name of Paul: a letter to the Christians in the city of Alexandria, and a letter to those in the town of Laodicea. These letters to the Alexandrians and the Laodiceans regrettably no longer survive, but we can be relatively certain that if they ever turn up, they will represent even more forcefully than the books of Martian's canon his distinctive views about the two gods, the non-human Jesus, and the salvation he brought. 3 Corinthians. It was quite common for Orthodox Christians, that is, Christians who accepted the theological views that eventually became widely accepted throughout Christianity, to charge heretics, those who taught false teachings, with forging documents in the names of the apostles in order to support their views. We will see much more of this phenomenon in chapter 6. The Gospel of Peter, for example, was charged with being heretical, as teaching a docetic view of Jesus. But Orthodox Christians forged documents of their own. We have far more of this kind of forgery, since Orthodox writings were more likely to be preserved for posterity, even if they were not actually written by their alleged authors. Everyone familiar with the New Testament knows that it contains two letters by Paul to the church in Corinth, called 1 and 2 Corinthians. What most people do not know is that outside of the New Testament is a book called 3 Corinthians. It is a fascinating book, penned in the name of Paul to oppose heretics like Martian. But Paul did not write it. It is an Orthodox forgery of the 2nd century. Like the stories of Thecla, 3 Corinthians is now found in the Acts of Paul. According to the account, two heretics came to Corinth propounding their false views: Simon the magician, whom we have met before, and Cleobius. The Corinthian Christians were disturbed by what they were hearing and wrote to Paul, asking him to correct the heretical teachings and come in person to straighten out those who had succumbed to them. This letter to Paul, forged in the name of the Corinthians, is the first part of 3 Corinthians. It sets out the claims of the two false teachers, namely, that it is wrong to appeal to the Old Testament prophets, that God is not almighty, that is, that the Creator God is not God over all, that there will be no future resurrection of the flesh, that the world was not created by God, that Christ did not come to earth bearing real flesh, that he was not born of Mary, and that the world was not created by God, but by angels. Much of this sounds like the teaching of Martian. As we have seen, Martian devalued human flesh because he rejected the idea that the Creator of this world is the true God. And the Creator, of course, is the one who made fleshly beings. As a consequence, the followers of Martian did not believe that the afterlife would be